Welcome to the Everything Financial Radio Podcast. I'm your host, Dennis Tubergen. Glad you're listening in again this week. As I often do, this week, once again, I have two special guest experts joining me. Joining me for the second part of today's podcast is Mr. Jim Babka. Jim is the president of DownsizeDC.org. I love the work that they do and periodically catch up with Jim to see what they're doing. Also, it's a great opportunity, given the political year that we find ourselves in, to talk some politics with Jim, and we'll do that on today's podcast. Joining me in just a moment will be Mr. John Kay. John is the author of the book Other People's Money. I caught up with John this past week from his London offices. John has a lot to say about whether or not there will be another financial crisis and how you might be affected. So I'll be chatting with John momentarily. Before I get to that conversation, let me remind you that if you're not yet a subscriber to our newsletter titled Portfolio Watch, I publish that every week. It's distributed Mondays at 5 o'clock Eastern. If you would like to become a free subscriber, just visit the website yourportfoliowatch.com and give us your email address, and we'll be glad to send it to you. The website is yourportfoliowatch.com. I'm pleased to have as a first-time guest on the Everything Financial radio program, John Kay. John is one of Britain's leading economists. He chaired the Review of UK Equity Markets and Long-Term Decision-Making. He is a visiting professor of economics at the London School of Economics and a fellow of St. John's College, Oxford. He writes a weekly column for the Financial Times. He has many other items on his resume and many other accomplishments that would take an entire segment if I were to mention them. So, John, let me just stop there and welcome you to the program.
Good to be here with you.
John, your most recent book, Other People's Money, contains information that really, I believe, is vital to listeners really all around the world. Can you explain what motivated you to write the book?
What motivated me was a sense that after the financial crisis of 2008, the analysis of the underlying causes of what had gone wrong were really quite superficial. And what had happened was really the result of a process over about 30 years, which I called financialization, in which finance had at once come to occupy a central role in our economies, and yet become more and more divorced from the real needs of the non-financial economy of businesses and households. And it was to explain this divorce from the real needs that the economy has from the financial system and to suggest some ways in which we could get that back that I wanted to write the book.
So, John, let's talk about that term financialization. You described that as something that occurred over a 30-year time frame. Can you get into a little more detail?
Yes. What I think many people outside finance don't understand is the extent to which people who work in finance actually trade with each other. I give the various examples in the book about how the volume of trading in foreign exchange is 100 times the underlying volume of global trade in goods and services, how we now have so-called high-frequency traders. They're actually computers which are trading with each other across lightning-fast telecoms links, and it's a computer at each end making the trade. And as you work that through, you start to ask, what is all this for, and why is it so profitable, or why is it apparently so profitable? Because one of the conclusions I reach is that a lot of the profitability of financial services is overstated.
So, John, you know, when we have talked to other guests and from my own research on the matter, one of the causes of the financial crisis was, at least in the United States here, the repeal of Glass-Steagall, which was an act that kept banks from being in the lending business and the securitization business. To what extent would you say that really played a role in the financial crisis?
I think that did play a role, although by the time Glass-Steagall was actually repealed in 1999, it had become not very effective. It was a gradual erosion rather than an abrupt repeal. But final repeal of Glass-Steagall and indeed its erosion was part of the way in which the financial services industry lobbied for a certain kind of deregulation. And there's an important issue here because a lot of people outside finance say that what we need is actually more regulation of the financial sector. Now, the truth is, in my mind, we have far too much regulation of the financial sector, but it's the wrong sort of regulation. What we've done is write ever more complicated rules for how these firms should behave. Now, Glass-Steagall, and thinking about Glass-Steagall, takes us back to what is, I think, the real central issue, which is we allowed the emergence of very large financial conglomerates, which are clashes of culture, conflicts of interest, and cross-subsidy across various activities. What we need to do to restore a more effective financial sector is to move back not just to Glass-Steagall and separation of commercial banking, retail and commercial banking from investment banking, but actually to separate the various functions of the modern investment bank itself. We need simpler institutions. A lot of people talk about too big to fail, but the real problem has been too complex to fail.
Well, John, when you talk about the too big to fail banks, one of the things that pops to mind is the level of derivative exposure, or these side bets, to use a simple term, between banks, which would be completely Absolutely. Unregulated. To what extent is that an issue?
I think the problem is not that it's unregulated. The problem is really the scale of it. And it's a huge issue. So that the total volume of assets which are subject to derivative contracts today is about $600 trillion. It's a mind-blowing number. It's actually 2 to 3 times the value of all the assets in the world. And 10% of that, there are two banks that each account for about 10% of that total, J.P. Morgan and Deutsche Bank. It's a story that has got, I think, completely out of hand.
So given that level of derivative exposure, and you made a statement that's 2 to 3 times the total of all assets in the world, that is mind-blowing, to use the term that you did. How can we avoid another financial crisis?
I think with this structure, we're not actually going to. But what we need to do is to get this operation to wind itself down. Now, there's some value in some derivative contracts, and there's some value in some speculative activity in financial markets. But we need to do two things. We need to ensure that speculative activity, the derivatives activity, is subsidiary to the main purposes of finance, not the main activity itself. And we need to stop that being done in institutions which, in the end, rely on the backstop of the taxpayer, so that people are engaging in these wildly excessive exposures because people are confident that, in the end, talks about J.P. Morgan and Deutsche Bank, in the end, these are the institutions that are not going to be allowed to fail. If you didn't think that, you wouldn't be willing to trade with organizations that have the kind of scale of size of balance sheets that they do.
Well, we are chatting today with John Kay. John's book is titled Other People's Money. I learned a lot about John's work at johnkay.com. I would encourage you to do the same. And the good news is I have another segment to chat with Mr. Kay, and I will do that when Everything Financial Radio returns. Stay with us. Well, I certainly hope you're enjoying my conversation with John Kay. This aired on the Everything Financial Radio program this past weekend. We're now sharing with you on the podcast, and I will get right back to that conversation now. I'm very pleased to be chatting today with John Kay. John is the author of the book Other People's Money, and we've been chatting with John about the financial sector, some of the issues and challenges in that sector. And John, in the last segment, you said something that I'd like you to expand on here that you didn't say this, but you said it's going to be difficult to avoid another financial crisis. Assuming we have another financial crisis, what does it look like?
It's hard to say, because all financial crises are, at least in their immediate form, different. You know, we've had 3-4 major financial crises over that era of financialization, with the Asian market debt crisis and the emerging market debt crisis of the 1990s. Then with the new economy bubble in 1999-2000. Then with the credit crunch in 2007-2008. And at the moment, we in Europe have this Eurozone crisis, which is a really ongoing crisis. It has its origins in the financial sector, but it's dragging down Europe's economies. At best, it will go on dragging them down. At worst, it may burst into some larger crisis. So that all of these look different. But actually, if you go and look at the underlying causes, they're all actually rather similar. What happens is you get some real change in the underlying economy, the invention of the development of the internet, or the emergence of some Asian countries into the global economy. And people, convergence in the Eurozone, people were early to see these trends, make money out of it. Then people in financial markets, because they have this enormous herd instinct, pile into it. You get people making the short term lots of profits, but you get serious asset mispricing, which we saw that emerging market debt was being funded at much too low interest rates. Stocks were grossly overpriced in the new economy bubble. Credit expansion was being given to people with no chance of paying it. Then all that gets corrected, and at that time, governments and central banks intervene to pump more money into the system in the hope of minimizing the damage to the rest of the economy. But all that does, it sets up fuel for the next crisis. And we can see some of the ways in which the fuel for the next crisis is there in China and in emerging markets, and in the kind of bubble we have in the bond markets at the moment.
Let's talk about that. We have extraordinarily low interest rates. Would you say this is attributable, at least largely attributable, to central bank policy?
So I think it's almost entirely attributable to central bank policy. Both the cuts in interest rates, which were to low levels, which were made immediately after the 2008 crisis, and the pumping of money through into the system through quantitative easing, which has forced down long-term interest rates as well as short-term interest rates. You have low interest rates in Germany, in the United States. If you look to other countries like Germany and Switzerland, you can see that the Swiss government has been issuing 10-year bonds with a negative interest rate. And if you want a 30-year German government bond, at the moment it will yield 0.7 or 0.8%.
You know, I was doing some research, and I read, John, that the last time that there were negative interest rates in Germany, you had to go back to the 20s, and we all know what followed that. We had a period of a significant currency crisis. So given these, you know, extraordinary policies of central banks, are we going to see currency crisis again?
I think we may see currency crisis. I'm not sure it's currencies that are going to be the next source of a major financial crisis. I would be looking at the two places of emerging markets and global bond markets. But we can't anticipate the nature and timing of crises. If we could, we do much better at avoiding them.
Well, that's a great point. As you're talking here, John, and we talk about the possibility of another financial crisis, here in the United States, we had the two big-to-fail banks that received a government bailout. When you look at some of the other measures that have been taken in countries like Greece, Cyprus, Ukraine, you've seen bail-ins where essentially depositors have lost some of the money they had on deposit. What do you see? Let's focus here on the United States. If we see another financial crisis, Is there a bailout that will occur, or do you think that the bail-in model might be more likely?
I suspect we're not going to find much bail-in when it comes to the point. I'm scared that these bail-in bonds are being issued to people who don't imagine that bail-in is actually going to happen. I further suspect that when push comes to shove, they will actually be right. The bail-ins won't be called. I fear that what we're doing is we're moving the point of bank rescue a bit forward so that central bank interventions come before banks get to the point of bailing creditors in. And frankly, in some places where these bonds are being sold to retail customers, I can't imagine that governments are actually, when it comes to the point, going to allow depositor people who bought these bonds to lose the money.
So when you look at, for example, here in the United States, Dodd-Frank, some of the regulation that was passed to try to prevent these issues from becoming issues again, and I think in the first segment you said that the regulation that has been implemented is the wrong kind and there's been far too much of it. Is Dodd-Frank in that category?
Dodd-Frank is in that category. I mean, Dodd-Frank does some good things, but it doesn't really get to the heart of the issue we were talking about earlier, which is the creation of these two complex, culturally conflicted financial conglomerates. Unless we're prepared to look at the structure of the industry, we're not actually going to get effective reform. And for me, what we need is to replace enormously long and complicated regulatory rule books, simpler rules about industry structure, and also personal responsibility for what goes on in institutions. One of the things that makes ordinary people angry about the 2008 crisis is that people at the top of large financial institutions that failed or came close to failure walked away with very large sums of money, whereas many people, including me, think some of them ought to be in prison. And I think what we ought to have is legislation that makes people at the top of institutions substantively responsible for what actually goes on in the companies of which they're in charge.
Well, I couldn't agree more. In fact, I think as a parent, we know that if you reward bad behavior, you get more of that behavior. So, John, just a couple, about 30 seconds left. If someone wanted to get their hands on your book, Other People's Money, what steps should they take?
Good bookshops or Amazon. You can get it either as print copy or ebook, and it's coming out shortly in the U.S. in paperback.
Perfect. Well, John, been a pleasure having you on the program today. We hope you'll come back.
Good. Thanks, Dennis. Good to talk to you.
Well, a special thanks to Mr. John Kay for joining us on this week's podcast. Now I'll get to my conversation that I had with Mr. Jim Babka. I am pleased to be joined by returning guest, Jim Babka. Jim is the president of the organization Downsize DC. I am a big fan of their work, and I support their work, and I would encourage you to consider doing the same. Jim, welcome back to the program.
Glad to be here, Dennis. Thank you.
Hey, Jim, for those listeners that maybe aren't familiar with Downsize DC, why don't you fill them in?
Well, Downsize DC is an organization that is attempting to reduce the size, the scope, and the power of the federal government in all areas very consistently, whether we're talking about intrusions into civil liberties, or we're talking about war, or we're talking about big budgets, deficits, debts, unfunded liabilities, high taxes. In every area, we're looking to try to reduce the size, the scope, and the power of the federal government, and we do this in a very specific way. We contact people on a regular basis through our email newsletter and encourage them to come and use a system on our website, downsizedc.org, that identifies for them who their representative and two senators are and allows them to send a personalized message that is delivered in such a way that that office knows that it's hearing from a constituent, and constituent messages are counted, and that those kind of census totals, if you will, the results of those letters are reported upwards to the chief of staff and the boss on a regular basis in most congressional offices. Your voice joined with others can make a difference, and so we're trying to make that process as easy as possible for you and people can use it at downsizeddc.org.
Well, terrific. Well, Jim, there's been a number of things that Downsize DC has been working toward, and I would love for you to talk about your free competition in Currency Act idea, which has been around a while, but certainly makes a lot of sense in light of current monetary policy. Can you fill the listeners in?
Yeah, the Free Competition and Currency Act is exactly what we're talking. We call it honest money. It's exactly what it sounds like. It would repeal the legal tender law, which gives the Federal Reserve a monopoly over the money supply. It would it includes a competitive currency section, which basically makes it legal to start minting your own coins and creating your own currency, which it presently is not legal. And it has a tax-free gold component to it, which basically means that if you want to try to switch into, you know, precious metals, coins, bullion, whatever, that you would not have the tax penalty that's associated with that conversion when dollars are inflated or deflated. You wouldn't be penalized by the activities of the state while you're doing it, trying to transition in and out of gold. So we believe this would cause the Federal Reserve and its product, which are dollars, to have to compete better in a marketplace. It would take away, reduce dramatically, anyway, I don't say take away, but to reduce dramatically the ability to inflate this currency, to keep just, you know, puffing it up for the benefit of the government and for inside contractors who get first benefit of those funds. So what we're suggesting is that everybody would have a greater degree of stability and control over the monetary supply and the inflation or deflation that results.
And Jim, I'm assuming that if something like that were to become law, it would make it impossible for the Federal Reserve to print money as they have, or, you know, use the term quantitative easing, whatever term you want. You perfume a pig, it's still a pig. But if assuming that there's some competition, it's going to really make politicians spend more honestly, and the Fed really has to keep the money honest and maintain some level of integrity.
That's exactly correct. Competition is the key elixir. And when you're looking at virtually any type of government program, almost every one of them could be improved by competition. What the government does, sometimes it shouldn't flat out be doing, but in those things that we actually tend to agree that maybe it has some role, or we want that product or service to exist out there somewhere and be available to us, competition would almost always make it better. And in this particular instance, money is no different. If there was competition in how we exchange goods and services, if we had more monetary choices, then the Federal Reserve would have to compete. That would make them much more accountable to the marketplace.
You know, Jim, the listeners are going to be very, it's going to be very obvious to the listeners that we don't script these conversations, but to what extent would you say some of the cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin are maybe coming more closely anyway aligned to that whole idea?
Well, I think it's wonderful that people are trying to find a way to step into the marketplace and compete, and that perhaps they've found a way around the laws that we presently have with Bitcoin. Now, you notice that there is an attempt both in some portions of the Bitcoin world and within the governments themselves that they want to try to figure out how they can begin to regulate and control even this currency. And, of course, they will do it in such a way that they continue to benefit their ability to inflate currency. I don't think right now that the Bitcoin usage is understood or accessible or widely used enough for it to have a real impact yet. We have a significant way to go before it can really truly be a competitive currency. But it is an attempt to get around some of the very problems that we are addressing in the Free Competition and Currency Act.
So, Jim, is this idea getting any traction? Do you have any members of the House or Senate in either party that have embraced this idea or signed on with you?
We helped Ron Paul craft this bill. We were responsible for one of the three things that I just told you it did, making sure that got added in so that it fully did the job. This was an idea, a Ron Paul idea, that we helped work with them to improve. Ron Paul is no longer in Congress, and he was the one talking about this. And unfortunately, I happen to disagree a little bit strategically with Dr. Paul and his team on this. There's been a much greater emphasis, much more time, money, and effort in promoting Audit the Fed. I am for Audit the Fed, just to be clear. But I think that even if the public found out that the Fed was engaged in certain bad behaviors, that wouldn't necessarily lead to the kind of reform we need. I really do think that markets, individuals acting, not politically, but in their normal everyday spending decisions, would have a far greater effect. That competition is really the key elixir to reforming the way that the Federal Reserve behaves.
And Jim, just to take this a step further, I've had a number of interviews of late with professors who've studied government intervention and regulation in financial markets, and others that are just writing about the banking system. And it seems that there's a pretty much a consensus that we're not out of the woods, that a lot of the same problems that caused the financial crisis of 8 years ago haven't gone away. In fact, by many measures, they've intensified. It seems that this whole idea of free competition and currency has to make bankers a little bit more honest as well.
Yes, it does. There's this whole world that I don't understand anywhere near as well as you and probably many of your listeners do. I don't follow it, and I'm not a finance guy. But there's this whole unseen world, this superstructure of credits and digits being transferred back and forth that vastly, vastly outnumbers the amount of dollars that are actually in existence. And many of those digits have claims on solitary dollars. By that I mean, Dennis, that, you know, we've committed the same dollar many, 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 many times over, so that if there's a break in the system like there was in 2008, the whole thing could come collapsing down and everybody finds their dollars vanishing. And the types of people who will find their dollars vanishing are pensioners, people with savings accounts, regular everyday people. We know full well that the state will do anything it can to take care of its well-heeled, large, too-big-to-fail cronies who help finance the system and keep the debt rolling. They did it before, and they've never really stopped. They've never really stopped to the point now that I think you're right. I think there is another bubble in place, and if you could, you know, predict exactly when it's going to go down, conceivably you could make quite a bit of money. I had a friend that helped me time this a little bit back in 2008, and I had a put that paid off a little bit, and I was thrilled to have it. I was glad to be in the right position at the right time, and I think. But the problem is that it's very, very hard to predict the future and know when this is going to come down. The friends that I've been listening to who are most concerned about this have been telling me for 2.5 to 3 years that it was going to come in the next quarter or two, and it still hasn't. So I'm always amazed, Dennis, by the number of stops, the number of tricks or rabbits that the established political establishment is able to pull out of its hat, and the desire for people to believe and play along that prolongs what should seem to be much more immediate consequences.
Yeah, and we're running out of time in this segment, but one comment along those lines. It's interesting that it's been known for a long time that the Fed actually intervenes in currency markets. That's one of the things that they do. But former Dallas Federal Reserve Bank President Richard Fisher, not long ago in a CNBC interview, stated that the Fed pumped $1 trillion into the U.S. stock market because they wanted to create a wealth effect. So, there's really no such thing as honest markets anymore.
And that's unfortunate that there is an institution that is this large and this unaccountable. And that such manipulation can go on. And it means that there's always somebody that is technically insider trading. There's somebody that's aware and understands how to pull these levers to their benefit. So people are profiting from this that are very well connected. Regular everyday people who may want to enter the market are going to have a much harder time keeping up. They can't possibly have the connections or the expertise necessary to know exactly how all those levers are being pulled. They will only see the effects of it after it's happened.
Well, that's all the time we have for this segment, but the good news is we have one more segment with Mr. Jim Babka of Downsize DC. The website is downsizedc.org, and when we come back, I can't help it, we're going to have to talk some politics, so stay with us. Well, I really do appreciate the work that Downsize DC does. I would encourage you to check out the website at downsizedc.org. Now I'll get back to my conversation with Mr. Jim Babka. I'm pleased to be chatting today with Mr. Jim Babka. If you're just joining us, Jim's organization is Downsize DC. The website is downsizedc.org. I am a big fan of their work and a supporter of their work as well. I'd encourage you to check it out. And Jim, let's talk a little politics. I think we both look at things from a bit of a libertarian perspective. So How would you describe what we've just seen in the Democratic and Republican presidential primaries?
Anger. Unfocused rage. It's not surprising that people feel that they haven't been represented by these parties, that these parties are bought and paid for and owned by some entity that they believe controls these strings. I'm a little bit more familiar with the Republican side of this story because I happen to know more Republicans personally, and I was once upon a time a Republican. And there was a movement called the Tea Party, and the Tea Party tried very hard to bring a couple of different issues to the table. The initial two issues that mattered most included how much money the government was spending and Obamacare. And, you know, they wanted something done about debts and deficits. They wanted the corporate welfare turned off. There were Republicans that wanted that. There was an Occupy movement on the left that was also opposed to corporate welfare. And neither party picked up the message. Both attempted, and the Tea Party made it so easy for it to be co-opted. This decentralized movement, as soon as politicians showed up and started talking to them, they're like, oh, they swooned. Oh, we're getting attention. They really care about us. And the leaders, who had very little experience with what they were dealing with, ended up selling out the entire movement. But the sentiment didn't disappear. There were still lots of people that held it. And they gave Republicans majorities, and bigger majorities, so that the House has the largest majority the Republicans have had in any of our lifetimes, by far, and nothing changed. Nothing happened. In fact, they found that their issues were discarded, put to the side. They were told that they had to keep waiting, keep waiting, keep waiting. They needed bigger majorities. They needed the presidency. They always needed something more. Nothing could ever be done. And if you're familiar with Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, you know that's a bunch of malarkey. You know that Congress doesn't have to fund anything it doesn't want to fund. Republicans can zero out funding on anything they want, and there's little or nothing the president can do about it. But they don't want to fight. And people got frustrated. They didn't get listened to. And one of the issues that they didn't get listened to, unfortunately, is borders. I say unfortunately because I don't happen to agree with this position. I think that the free movement of people and goods, people endowed with rights by their creator, by the way, the free movement of people and goods is good for trade, is good for peace, militarily speaking, and that it should be encouraged. We should be, you know, taking advantage of as much talent as we can possibly take advantage of. We should want it all here. That said, people weren't listened to, and now they're expressing themselves in rage. And on the left, they tried to overcome the establishment that had built in rules to kind of hem in the rage, but there was no similar rules in place by a Republican establishment that hadn't listened. And so they ended up with a really strange nominee who isn't particularly conservative, hasn't been Republican for very long, and has no particular commitment to any type of vision issue-wise. And so there's very little that we can tell for certain that he is going to do. He's taken multiple sides on most issues. And people were willing to go back and make a classic historical mistake by the millions, apparently, on the left and put a socialist in office. And I think all of this, Dennis, is directed by rage. All of it is a focus of anger not being listened to, that the establishment didn't hear them sooner.
And Jim, it's just my take that just as kind of an outsider looking in, I'm not a member of either political party either, but on the Democratic side, you have a process that was literally almost rigged from the start, given the superdelegates and how many were pledged before anybody even cast a vote. So it really didn't matter what the voters said there to some extent. And on the Republican side, you have this this Trump movement, if you will, that nobody took seriously to start. And now I almost think there's some high-level Republicans that would just like to see Hillary win and take another shot at it in 4 years. So, I mean, it seems like neither side's getting the message yet.
No, they're not getting the message yet. They're trying to they're resisting to the bitter end. And this is part of the problem why I had a hard time getting excited, even as we saw many uprisings that took out leaders. You know, the majority leader or the majority whip lost his seat in a primary a few years ago, and now we've had a speaker that's had to step down. And there were, at both times, there was some celebration. We're getting through. We're showing the establishment who's boss. But the next thing the establishment would do is it would reach down into its ranks of cardinals, so, you know, the people who were the highest ranking, and they would say, here we go, we're going to put this guy in place. And he's going to say some things at the outset to make to soothe everybody and make everybody think it's going to be okay. And things would go back to normal. Maybe the rhetoric would change. Maybe they'd learn a couple rhetorical lessons, but they wouldn't learn any actual lessons. And so, I don't know whether this is healthy or not. I'm nervous. I got to be honest with you. I'm nervous with the choices that we have. I believe we have a shapeshifter on the left and on the right. I think we have a demagogue on the right and a warmonger on the left. It is fascinating to me how bad the situation is in which we find ourselves. But there still might be the very most sliver of an opportunity, because I was involved in the Libertarian Party. I worked for Harry Brown when he ran for president. I was his press secretary in his second campaign in the year 2000. And I can tell you that what's happening with Gary Johnson and William Weld, who are the Libertarian nominees for president and vice president, what's happening with them in the polls, what's happening with them in media coverage, is unscaled. This is, we've never had anything like this before. If they can get into the debates, I think there is a chance for history to be made and for them to have a very significant impact on the election. Will they get into the debates? Well, that's a big, big if. The establishment's going to want to prevent that from happening, and they built a tool that they thought was pretty foolproof to stop it. But this is an unusual year and an unusual opportunity where dissatisfaction's at an all-time high, and if people have anger, I hope they'll focus it into something that will actually make a difference, which is to stop having the state involved in every aspect of our life, and that's exactly what Gary Johnson and Bill Weld are proposing. I can't speak on behalf of Downsize DC, but I'm as a person, I would prefer greatly, and I intend to vote for that candidate.
We're going to have to leave it there. Guest today has been Mr. Jim Babka. His organization is Downsize DC. Check it out at downsizedc.org. And, Jim, it's always a pleasure to catch up with you, and hope you'll come back.
Thank you, Dennis. I always enjoy it.
Well, that concludes the Everything Financial Radio podcast for this week. Hope you got something you can use, and I'll be back again next week with more information about helping you manage your money. Talk to you then.